You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello and welcome to another Damn Fine Cup of Culture. Today we're bringing you the second episode in our summer series about lost films, lost actors, lost things in general. And to sort of go in depth a little bit, we have prepared a pretty general episode that goes about lost silent films, lost television, films that are there only in part, and films that we might rediscover even. Alan and Sam are joining me today.
Hello.
Hey, Julie.
Thank you for coming. Thank you for your company. And I wanted to kick off with the first question. We all know that there's stuff that's gotten lost in terms of our film history. And I wanted to ask you both, what would you have saved from the fire if you could?
I mean, I guess my simple pat answer is, I think, The Missing Hitchcock, because that just feels like the completest dream to just have all of it. And the fact that there's an odd few missing just feels like, oh, we could just complete the spreadsheet of you could watch everything. That feels like the standard answer is really where I'd go with that. I think the thing that is bigger is the stuff you don't know that you're missing. The stuff that's been lost that we haven't been able to reappraise. So a film that is just a line somewhere, oh, this film is missing, no one famous is on it. But if we got to see it, would be brilliant. So I don't know whether, if I could save something, it would be a random selection of films just to, like, you know, surprise everyone in the future.
I definitely have to agree with Alan. I mean, Hitchcock's first and his first short movie, I think that's probably the one with the biggest mythology around it. And there's a big Hitchcock buff, of course. I would love to see it. But I think there's also something fascinating in not having it. I think in a way, we'll talk about this later maybe, having this mythology and imagining the films that did exist at one point, but we can only see like in a couple of stills or descriptions or reviews. I think it's also a great thing to have, you know, even though I'd wish at one point it would be rediscovered and we just get a fantastic first edition. But maybe we need lost films as well to have that.
Mm. I mean, Hitchcock always said he was glad it was missing. They're not very good. I'm kind of happy that no one gets to see them. And you can sort of understand that. And it maybe isn't very good, but I think you get to the level of just, I need to see it for completist sake rather than for enjoyment.
Yeah, I'm going to cheat a little bit. I want to save Theda Bara's Film Vault. Because silent films, I love silent films for one. I think everybody knows that. Our listeners know that. And a lot of them were lost. So the Library of Congress in America says it's about 75% of them got lost. Some sources go as high as 90% of silent films are lost. So that is a big part of our history, of our heritage as well. And the story goes, Theda Bara was a very famous film star of the very, very early days. She did these vamp roles in which she was this femme fatale who was irresistible to men and so on. And a lot of her stuff has been lost for the usual reasons. Nitrate film is very flammable. There were fires. It needs to be stored a certain way. But there were also studios who were like, yeah, who want to see this after, you know, it's been released. It's just junk. And storage is expensive, so they just burn the lot and throw it away. But Theda Bara had a private film collection of her own films, which she saved and which she stored incorrectly and which consequently decayed, and we no longer have it. So that I would want to see. I want to have that collection. I really would. And it just, because you can't store it in airtight containers, you have to store it on racks. You have to, you know, it's just very difficult to store that stuff. So it got ruined. And it's such a pity, because that I'd want to see. Yeah.
I'm sort of imagining now, Julie, a bit like with those videos in the Criterion closet where they get famous people to pick their favourite films. I'm imagining you get into the Theda Bara closet where all her archive is, and you can help yourself to whatever you want from the shelves.
That would be a dream.
Oh, God, and these decayed films, they fall out, you know, just like bits and pieces of dust maybe coming down from... I think there's like the issue of like the nitrate, but there was also something around the vinegar that I read where films also like kind of imploded in a way or got self-destroyed without burning down an entire archive. So I think that they tried to fix it, and then the fix didn't work. So this took a while before they really found the formats to store film.
Yeah, and it also happened by accident. There are stories of films being found in salt mines and in goodness knows what else. And a lot of it obviously is just lore. It's myth, right? You're not going to find a film reel in Granny's attic that'll make you a millionaire. And one of the reasons is that the studio that burned the film in the first place or destroyed it still has the copyright there too. So you can't go to the judge and say, okay, the studio just burnt this film, so now it's mine. No, it's not. Unless the copyright runs out, it's still with the rights holder and all the images therein. This is why we can't put Chaplin's images on an article without crediting them, because there's a rights holder to those.
I mean, I think the reason then is just if you find it in Granny's attic, just keep quiet about it for a few more years. Just wait till the copyright expires and then sort of bring it out.
Yeah.
Are you saying that there's lots of grannies who secretly hold on to, you know, the first Hitchcock and Curtis and Cukor? And
I mean, we're not going to know unless, you know, we start looking. I mean, that's all I'm saying.
I hope so. I have these. Somebody should make a movie about that alone, like, right? It's like an old mogul passes away and they open this big vault and it's full of films and goodness knows what's in there and how does that work? I mean, I wrote an article about the restoration of Metropolis that was lost twice and got found and got restored, and it's such a great story. I love that sort of stuff. I really do.
But there are also rumors sometimes that private collectors do hoard these things. So there's definitely, like, there's talk that, you know, someone has a copy, but, you know, partly because he doesn't own the copyright, but partly because he's probably very wealthy and quite evil. They just hold on to them. They have a copy. They show it to friends as like a show-off thing, but they're not interested in like releasing it to the general public. And how much truth there is really hard to know, but there's a whole mythology about private collectors owning stuff that is still technically listed as being lost.
Yeah, I was unsure of that because it sounds so romantic and everything that sounds very romantic probably isn't real. But if it's real, I'm firmly on the side of Indiana Jones. That belongs in a film museum.
Yep.
Give it back to us because it's our legacy as well as yours. Don't be greedy. If I found that thing, I couldn't wait. I would call everybody going like, oh, look, I found like 5 seconds of an old silent that nobody knows about. I would be so excited.
Yeah, give it back or we're going to sneak in, like you said, Indiana Jones style and steal it.
I imagine this to be a fantastic party somewhere in the Hollywood Hills where some old gentlemen and some limousines drive up and then they have like they used to have in the 30s, you know, when they showed these risque films with all kinds of people coming up in stealthily, and now they're just watching The Mountain Eagle or The Elastic Affair or whatever it's going
to
be.
Instead of porn, as it used to be.
But there was sort of tales, I think less so now that information is far more out there. But I think in the early days when people were trying to recover the archive, that they would go to like private screening and the film would be shown. And they'd go, well, this is missing. And the person who owned the film had no idea that this was a missing film. They just thought, oh, I've got an old film. I fancy showing it. It's quite fun. I've got a projector. And they didn't realize that obviously what they had is, you know, the studio didn't have a copy anymore. No one knew there were any copies around. And it kind of gets discovered by someone attending one of these screenings. And the person does not know that they must be dozens of these. So there's quite a few recoveries that come from someone realizing a screening that they're attending is of a film that is technically listed as missing. But I think now the archive search has been going for decades now, and I think with the internet and like lists of information, that's much less likely to happen. But I think in the early days it was really common.
Yeah, and why would they know? I mean, you have sort of hokey film reel that's a lot of fun, but how would you know whether it's somewhere in a studio vault or not, or in some library somewhere or in a museum? You don't know, of course. Anyway, if you find an old film can in anyone's attic, call people who know about it and don't throw it away, okay?
Well, that sort of links quite nicely, I think, to the thing that I was sort of wanting to talk about, the notion of the search, because when it was suggested doing lost things, where I really became aware that we'd lost media was in UK television. And sort of growing up, it was already a thing of like, we had these classic TV shows and we don't have all of them, or we have episodes missing. And primarily it was because UK television they didn't even film anything. It was shot on videotape, and the videotape was expensive and they'd want to reuse it. So they'd shoot something, they'd broadcast it, and then when it came to shoot something else, it was like, well, we'll just record over what we did before. And there was a sort of feeling, again, a bit like, why would we hold on to this? You know, why would people want to watch something from 2 or 3 years ago? Another factor was when TV started, and they started, I mean, originally it was all completely live, but when they started recording for broadcast, sort of actors and unions were like, well, hang on, what's to stop the TV companies filming enough that they can just fill the schedule? They'll never have to film anything again. There's this real concern that they would get paid for filming something, and then the TVs would just play it again and again and again while the actors stayed out of work. So it became the case in the UK that if you were to reshow something, you would effectively have to pay everyone involved pretty much what you paid them when you made it. So they would have this right to payment for a performance that wouldn't sort of depreciate really much at all over time. So suddenly you're holding onto this videotape from a couple of years ago. If you do broadcast it, it's going to cost you similar to making something new. The impetus then is to make something new.
Yeah, those were the days, right? I mean, nowadays you just get the studio that sues you blind.
But it's sort of a weird case where television made a sort of similar mistake to early cinema, that early cinema went through this process of like, this is ephemeral, we've made it, it's gone out, it's made some money, what's the point of keeping it? And so we lost so much early cinema. And there's this weird period that, like, television in the 60s is pretty much doing the same thing. They're making something. The feeling is it gets broadcast. It's been broadcast. It's ephemeral. And therefore, it's recorded over. So you've got these huge chunks of archive British TV missing. And even when I was quite young, that was quite a new story. So you would have this thing where, you know, they would find stuff. And the search seemed quite exciting, that people would, how they would locate these lost TV shows, because, you know, sometimes copies were made to be sold overseas. So suddenly someone would go to this tiny little TV rebroadcasting relay station in Australia and they'd find missing episodes of television. And it's still sort of happening that people are finding stuff where you wouldn't expect.
So I know this story primarily. This was interesting. I think we talked about this before, Alan. I get these old TV kicks sometimes, right? So you watch lots of The Twilight Zone or something else or something silly. And I sort of thought to collect The Avengers, a very old one. And I was shocked to learn that there are episodes of The Avengers. This is a famous TV. This is not some niche sort of zero budget amateur show. This is like The Avengers, and there was stuff missing. I was absolutely sure. I was like, why wouldn't they preserve that? That is,
I guess it took a while for them to really understand, you know, the value of the show itself as a cult item. I think with The Avengers, I just noted after the first season and then Honor Blackman coming in and obviously Diane Rick later on, you know, it just grew in appreciation and it became this huge cult thing. I guess also with the US broadcast and starting with one of the seasons with Diane Rigg. And I think in a way, that process that you mentioned before, Alan, of early cinema, early TV, until that realization is there, you can't leave it up to the studios only, right? There needs to be some kind of outside appreciation, either, I don't know, a fan base or really a cultural phenomenon or someone, you know, creating archives for the first time and saying, well, we're not just keeping texts and books, but we need some kind of archive to store these new media. And I think it's interesting, you know, how long does it take from the heyday of early cinema and early TV until that process is there where you say, okay, so we have this proper storage system and we're going to make sure that this is properly labeled and kept and, yeah, then not lost within the archival system.
I mean, what's sort of incredible, and I know about the UK TV situation, I'm not sure how it works elsewhere, is that it really affects very famous TV programs. So TV broadcasts that had huge viewing figures that were like a big deal at the time are still missing. You'd kind of understand it if, okay, nobody kept like a local news broadcast from 1962 when very little happened. You can kind of think, okay, that's niche, there's no need. But like Quatermass, which was a huge TV series, is missing episode. That there is something that they just did not make the connection that this is a popular TV show. Maybe we should hold on to it. It was, yeah, it was a popular TV show, but TV doesn't work like that. TV is ephemeral. We carry on and we make new stuff. And it is this whole thing that is sort of slightly in the geeky culture in the UK, that you're aware that stuff is missing. You're aware of the processes of finding it. And there's an event that sometimes happens at the British Film Institute, I think it's like annual or semi-regularly, that is called Missing Believed Wiped, where they, you know, anything that's been found in the last year is sort of brought to show, we found this, we found this episode of a sitcom, we found this, you know, program that at the time was huge that we've thought lost. And also that then builds into the story of how they found them. Where was this recovered? What was found? And some of those are just really interesting. Again, you know, it does come close to being Granny's Attic. It is like people going somewhere and they just think, oh, maybe on the off chance there might be something in these old like tapes that are about to be sort of destroyed. And I mean, one on the really geeky end, which is probably the most famous one in terms of the UK, is the science fiction show Doctor Who, which is missing a big chunk of its 60s stories for exactly that reason. They did not think it was worth keeping it.
And that's Doctor Who. I just want to underline and underscore here, this is not some sort of niche, as you say, local news broadcast from Yorkshire here, right? What we're talking about.
And so you have this thing where the videotapes were being deleted, but it was being sent to, you know, at the time, different corners of the empire to be broadcast. And then what they'd do then is they'd basically make a film copy. So they'd literally film the videotape being, you know, played. And a lot of the early stuff that exists now that you can watch actually comes from like a film of the video. And they could do all sorts of restoration so it's more watchable. But yeah, this thing that people would make these copies to be sent all around the world is what saved so much of it.
And I'm just thinking of you know, the heyday of now DVD and Blu-ray, where TV became available again in box sets, like over a couple of decades now, that we really have seen so many shows being or receiving re-editions, and then that creates additional interest in having, you know, a complete show or the next season. Or I'm just remember, you know, Columbo, that was like released one season after the other over several years. And it just made you aware that, oh, there are all these other shows that we also need to tackle. Maybe that was also a golden age where these shows were, you know, becoming such an interest from so many people again, that maybe there was more an incentive of going on these searches and doing restorations and then also properly publishing them as well as storing them, because I think that's sometimes something that needs to go hand in hand, right? There needs to be a market for someone who wants to watch them. Someone's going to pay for a box set, but then also, you know, film geeks who are super into, or TV geeks who are super interested in maybe seeing them in some kind of screening as well, and the archival process kicking in.
Yeah, I don't quite understand. That's because I'm such a nerd that I never quite understand. I mean, we're talking here about somebody filming a piece of reel from a UK television series somewhere in Canada or Australia. I can't get over that. It's such a romantic story. Somebody should make a movie. I mean, I love that stuff. And I think a lot of people do, right? This has an Indiana Jones level of, yeah, maybe it's just me, but I love that sort of stuff.
I mean, the other thing that you get with UK TV is the episode might be missing, but we've got audio of it. And the reason that would happen is obviously in the days before VHS and everything like that, people who wanted a copy at home, there were these people that basically they sort of opened up the telly, they soldered themselves in a connection to some sort of cassette recorder or reel-to-reel recorder. And when their famous favorite TV programs were on, they recorded the sound. They knew they would never capture the images, but there was a feeling that sort of like, yeah, but I like this. I'd like to have a version of it that I can listen to again. And especially with Doctor Who, that pretty much the archive does exist in audio. The whole thing's there because these people who were just smart enough to know how to solder a recording device into the standard telly they had at home did it, and then recorded episodes to listen to again. And we've got all of those that sort of give us a clue about what we might be missing.
Imagine Doctor Who and radio play. That is fantastic.
But yeah, it is sort of this strange world of this is missing and we're looking for it and we're finding it. That has such a big thing in terms of the legacy of UK television, that I was aware of that long before I kind of realised that even Hollywood was missing films. That I kind of, you kind of seem Hollywood's huge and rich. They're not going to be this stupid. So it's sort of quite interesting that like my background isn't so much like knowing about missing films. It started with missing telly and finding out what isn't there from the TV archive, and only later realizing that, yeah, Hollywood has made this mistake too.
Yeah, Movies Silently, great website, does lots of information on silent films. Go check out Fritzy online. Has this analogy where you used to have this collection of Barbie dolls or toy cars or baseball cards or Pokemon cards, you know, that just lived in boxes in your old room. And when people ask you, where is it gone? You say, well, my mom threw it all out when I went to college, right? This is what happened in Hollywood. This was what happened here too. It's not because nefarious people want to burn our cultural legacy. It's just because they're going like, yeah, you know, reasons. We just have reasons. We don't have to keep all this stuff, right? Who's going to watch it? Who's going to care? And it turns out quite a few people care quite a lot.
Yeah, not just space issues that play a role, because, I mean, that might be the smallest problem, but also, you know, studios not taking their responsibility seriously or closing down or being sold. And I'm just thinking, you know, what happens to all the stuff when United Artists went bust in the early 80s? And you think, well, what do you do with this huge archive of things of a studio that is being bought by somebody else? I would just be interested. I'm not too familiar with how that's like organized, but I'm always wondering, the studios who make those films, are they really the ones that should be at the helm of also preservation? And I'm glad that, we'll talk about this later, maybe other institutions have stepped in and they've also taken up some of that responsibility, restoring or storing then these or studying them. And therefore there is an archive that then has materials to study. And that includes also a lot of film.
Yeah, I think Filmstruck is a pretty good example. That used to be a platform that was quite a low bar to be able to watch niche movies, you know, and also old and classic movies. And they had to sunset it because it was, quote unquote, not profitable. And as you say, Sam, sometimes it's just clumsiness, as Alan detailed, right? They just record over the tape because, you know, tapes cost money or storage costs money. But sometimes it's also just a kind of, I'm sorry to say, it's a kind of laziness in which, okay, we looked at the bottom line, meh, not quite there, pity. Let's just sunset it. You see that with collections that are being, where the rights are sold, right? Like, for instance, I don't know who has a great deal of the Fox archives and that sort of thing. They can just shelve it and never release it because they own the stuff. And I remember this was back in the day with, I think it was called Magnolia. That was also a rights holder. And I used to get really angry that they would buy the rights to things only to then not release them. And I was like, okay, either you put it online somewhere and ask a quarter for every time anyone wants to watch it, and you don't give me this, oh, I can't make any money out of it, right? Or you release it properly. But this is no way to treat these films. And I mean, there are a lot of, I don't want to get into the weeds on this, but there are a lot of these types of stories that films were made. There were lots of people involved. And then there's one rights holder who says, yeah, but if it's not going to make me any money, sorry, guys. You know, and, you know, it's just nobody knows where it is. Some stuff, nobody knows who the rights holder is. It's just in limbo and nobody can release it because nobody knows who to ask. This stuff, and I don't want to get too much into the weeds of this, but some of this stuff is insane. This is Disney villain level insanity, right? It gets to me. It really does.
Yeah, and Indiana Jones style searches, you know, with somewhere at the very back of this archive, you might find the missing piece, the lost item. I'm a bit more familiar with the lost tapes for soundtracks, for film music. So I know a little bit the process of how that happens, how there needs to be an almost detective type person who knows who to ask, like you say, who might have a hunch which studio might hold the original tapes that were never put, for instance, already on a LP or CD. And then if they have their labels and their connections and they go and ask and they go look for these tapes and they get access to the actual archive, then they might actually come up with stuff that is astonishing. It's there. It's not lost in that sense, because over the years, I've seen so many works come out, surprisingly, that were considered lost forever, but they're not. They're lying around, sometimes mislabeled, misplaced, you know, and stored in bits and pieces. with weird codes, but if you make an effort, and I think that's the problem, who makes the effort and why, and will they make money from this? And very often it's just, you know, small additions that come out, so it's still rare, but it's there.
We're going to talk about this a little bit later because we have a lot of stuff to get through before that, but there is, of course, if the copyright ends after, I think it's 75 years in the Union and 100 years in the US, so it's a long time, but if that ends, now it's public. So that ancient Marion Davies movie that was made in 1927, that's a free-for-all, right? If someone finds that, if someone says, I'm going to recolorize that, I'm going to make some music, I'm going to release a Kickstarter on that, we could do that. But we're going to get into that a little bit later. First, you've said something very interesting, Alan, is that some of the stuff we have, some of the stuff we don't. And I want to make a little bit of a bridge because this happens in film as well, right? We talked, what seems like a long time ago now, about A Star is Born. The original cut of that, we only have access to in stills. So we have some of the film, some of it is in stills with sound underneath. Some of it is not there at all, right? So some of these things are only exist in parts. And Sam, I wanted to ask you about that particular side of things.
That's what I found most fascinating, getting into film in the first place. You know, that started obviously with Hitchcock, but also with James Bond. There were famous scenes that were filmed and not put into certain versions for political reasons. Bond breaking into an office in Switzerland didn't exist in some of the versions, and it was only restored later on. That's the first missing scene I was ever aware of. Or I'm thinking of Torn Curtain, the piece where Paul Newman meets the brother of the killer that he just killed, and they look so much alike, and there is some kind of sausage factory involved. So you heard about...
We can understand why that sort of didn't get by the censors, right?
But they filmed it, there are stills, you know, and of course that got me into the so-called on the cutting room floor topic, where we do have films that we love or that we're aware of, and then we start reading, and I guess also, you know, the internet, IMDb, all these the sites that had information suddenly on supposed versions of films that once existed and scenes that were cut, that were lost. And I think that's such a... obviously also such a source of mythology for famous films, of early films, but also later films. And I think we recently talked about The Private Lives of Sherlock Holmes, which, Alan, I think you're a big fan of. And of course, that was also changed dramatically because of studio ideas of how the film should be and while they're not getting a shot at it. So that's another famous example. So yeah, that from what I read about a lot of films is probably just as much as of a problem as... just as much of a fascinating aspect of lost film is stuff we don't have in bits and pieces. And we wish, you know, the next restoration or next Blu-ray edition will feature some of these. And of course, some of them might never reappear.
The first thing that came to mind is Ambersons, The Magnificent Ambersons, the Orson Welles one, which we also discussed in the past, where they try to cobble it together, right, from what we still have, not because the film was lost, but because we don't quite know how to put the version together from what's left. So there were program cards and I think, you know, all that sort of primary sources, little ads and things and reviews that were used to see what order stuff went in and how to finish that puzzle, right? Yeah.
I mean, I was sort of thinking, again, we're coming almost to a point where these sort of studios and these producers keep making the same mistake. So you've got into the era where they're obviously they are going to keep copies of films. Films are successful. It's worth having an archive. But anything that doesn't make the final cut of that film, they're just like, well, that's not important. So they don't think to keep that. That suddenly is like, well, we've got the final version of the film. That's important. We will keep a copy of that. But the stuff we took out, you know, you have to be lucky to get hold of this stuff because most of the time it just got junked. And you speak to sort of the directors and people like that, and there's a weird sort of disconnect when you come to like often in the 60s and 70s when they talked about stuff that was removed from the film, where they are quite ambivalent about it. I think like Billy Wilder is quite famously, he started making the film Kiss Me Stupid with Peter Sellers, and then Peter Sellers had a heart attack. And basically was told by his doctor, don't do anything for 6 months. So they brought someone else in to play the lead in the film. That's the version you can find is with his replacement. But they shot for 6 weeks with Peter Sellers on a Billy Wilder film. That sounds to me like incredibly intriguing. And then when Billy Wilder was asked about the footage, he seemed quite ambivalent. Like, it might be somewhere. He thought he didn't think it was kept, but he didn't seem to sort of feel that, like, yes, this thing I worked on that is of interest to people is lost. Maybe I should hunt it down. Though I think there was a feeling that if it didn't make the final film, that's the same, shrug, move on. And it's the sort of same mistake that, like, this stuff is worth keeping, and if you don't realize it, then you lose all this stuff.
Yeah, we always think we're better historians than our predecessors, and it's just not true. I mean, the case in point, I think, is Lawrence of Arabia, which was screened in its entirety as it was meant. Then it was cut up. Then it was cobbled back together from, I think, old. They had to redub some of it because the audio was lost. And then, of course, you get the issue that some actors have either aged or perhaps died. We always think, well, we wouldn't do that again now, would we? But we are doing it like all the darn time. And we are sort of crying hot tears about the lost stuff in Magnificent Ambersons. And there was this one Holocaust movie that was never released and it was lost. And the filmmaker was asked, right, will we ever see this movie? And he was so ashamed of it. He was like, no, never, ever, right? I will never show this because I hate it so much.
I mean, that is part of, you know, stuff being missing, is that when the director just says, I don't want you to see that. So famously, Dr. Strangelove, they originally shot ending with a food fight. And I went with Matt of this podcast. We went to the Stanley Kubrick archives in London and you could request what you want to see, but you can't. There's stills from the custard pie fight. But what is always interesting is, does that footage exist? And I think one of the reasons the archive is quite coy about it is because Stanley Kubrick did not want that scene. It was not in his film. So even if it exists, we're not going to see it. And I think another example of that is with Woody Allen, with a lot of especially his early films, that he'd often film a lot. And he would say he discovers the film in the edit. So there's whole subplots and original plans for a film that get lost and it turns into something else. And again, he has said no one will see that stuff. I think partly because he reuses some of the ideas that gets taken out.
This is a little drawer, right, with the ideas.
Yeah, I had a sketch, I had a character, we cut that from the film, but maybe I can use it in a later film. But it is sort of interesting that, like, this stuff is probably in an archive somewhere, all this stuff that was edited out. And it is the director that goes, but you're never going to see it because I don't want you to see it.
Someone who is very famous for this is Charlie Chaplin. He was the biggest incinerator of his own material that I know of. That was intentional. He just burnt the stuff. He didn't want us to see it because, one, it wasn't finished. Two, he was a perfectionist. He was a maladaptive perfectionist. And also because the stuff that we still do have that we dug up with Una Chaplin's kind permission, it also shows us tricks that Charlie Chaplin would do. He didn't want us to see how it was done, how the magic trick was done, right? There's this scene in which an axe almost falls on his foot. That also was lost and was dug up again. And if you reverse engineer that it was filmed in reverse. And so it looks like this axe just drops like a millimeter from his foot, but it was shot backwards. And I think he just didn't want us to learn of the tricks that he used in his special effects as they were, really.
To discover that, yeah. I mean, I'm thinking of on the other side of that also, you know, directors not wanting things to be released. But then, of course, we have also the opposite, right, of director's cuts that came up at one point. And suddenly we had a chance to see that lost footage again after studios had stepped in and just demanded these cuts. I mean, Sherlock Holmes that we mentioned before, it's just one example, but just so many in the course of film history, so many films that were massively too long. I'm thinking of Intolerance by D.W. Griffith. I just read about that in my box office poison film book that I just finished, which was, I think, 8 or 9 hours long. And then obviously it had to be cut down by hours and hours and the stuff was just gone from the film. So at that time, I think there was not a process in place where there could have been a director's cut coming out. But I think since the 70s, I guess, what's first? Is it Apocalypse Now with the, you know, director's cut coming out so many years later? I remember Das Boot, you know, the Wolfgang Petersen TV and cinema versions, and then director's cuts coming out. At one point, that just started to become a thing. and the possibility that there would be separate releases and there would be a market for director's cuts that I think finally gave access to things. Let's say if Stanley Kubrick would have wanted the Pie Fight to be in the film, that could have been the chance for it to be put back in there.
Right, but they're not always better than the cinema cut. And so this comes another one of my little irritations. We did an episode on Amadeus. This is an 80s film. It's not like a big classic film noir or anything. And the only thing I could find was the darn director's cut. And it's just not better than the cut that was initially screened. I'm sorry for all the people who have now offended, because there are obviously people who prefer this longer cut, but I do not. So keep both. As I said, we're not necessarily better historians than our predecessors. Just then don't throw the other one away, please, right? Because this is annoying.
I think it is something quite interesting about how director's cuts sort of came along and then suddenly people realized, okay, we'll let the director back into the cutting room and make what he wanted, you know, for a VHS release or for DVD. I think that was the prime driver. They realized that, okay, we released Blade Runner in the cinema, but it's got a cult following now. How can we make more money from it? Well, we can make more money from it by bringing Ridley Scott back and releasing a version that is Ridley Scott's preferred version of Blade Runner. I think this market develops where suddenly there's this interest in what have we got that we can start putting back into the films. And of course, it's driven by that desire for money. It's not necessarily driven by the desire for we want to get the pure original film that probably never would have existed. So you have got a situation where director's cuts come out because there's the extra footage. Let's use the extra footage to basically have another bite of money from people wanting to see it. I mean, I will say I tend to be quite relaxed about that, in the sense that, yeah, I've seen director's cuts films that aren't as good as the original film, but I've sort of enjoyed watching them anyway. It's quite nice to see them and at the end go, right, that was an interesting insight into maybe what the director wanted to do or some other stuff they filmed. I'm not going to watch it again. I'll go back to the original. But I think that has sort of transformed in many respects. The studio suddenly thought everything we're not putting in the film, everything we're deleting, probably worth keeping. And it's probably not worth saying the director can destroy this or keep it for the public, because this might make us money. And so we're going to hold on to all this stuff. And if this is a success, we can go 2 or 3 years later, oh, look, we're now releasing the extended edition, I think they often call it, if the director's not necessarily about. They can just go, oh, it's a longer version.
Yeah. And also pure revisionist history. I mean, Han shot first. Star Wars famously was just redone by Lucas because he felt like it. And I remember the internet, you know, in a tizzy, because then the original one, the one that we grew up in, the one that was released in 1977, that's now lost too. Of course, we still have it. And the director made this decision, but I don't think it's a very good decision.
I mean, it's interesting. We've got a festival starting very soon in London, which is basically showing films on film. And they have announced, and like, you're not going to get a ticket. They're showing a print of the original Star Wars before George Lucas did all that. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's got a lot of excitement. You're not going to get a ticket for it. That's sold out very quickly. I think it's like you have to, you know, that sort of shows that actually not having it out there for a while has built up this desire, which again, they'll make a lot of money from the screening. They'll probably justify, actually, let's go back and now get another chunk of money from the new original version of the film.
But didn't they release even these old versions again? Because there was pressure from the fans. You know, there were the original editions where they took out all the added digital stuff again, and it kind of looked like the original. So I think there's probably a market for this. Yeah.
I think ultimately, you know, if it's not been destroyed, can we call it lost? Because stuff does get found.
Yeah.
That's true. I mean, look at the Metropolis story with its double release and restoration. I remember buying the DVD of the restored version in like 2002. And then literally a few years after, this Argentina cut showed up and suddenly there was much more. I didn't even realize it wasn't the same version anymore. You know, I was so sure that I had the complete version in hand.
That was the version. It was known as the version. It was what we had. And then I wrote an entire rigmarole about this. Someone called someone who called someone else who said that they thought that there was a version somewhere in South America that had footage so that we could couple this film together again. And then it got re-released. And there was also an 80s version of Metropolis with a crazy soundtrack and that went all poppy and things. It's because they just ran wild with it, right? Because the copyright had run out. Yeah, I got the version that was re-released and rescued in top secret by a film preservationist from South America. Yeah, I love that story. And Lawrence as well, where they sort of try to cobble back together the version that we now view as the original version that was first screened for Her Majesty the Queen, but which never made it into cinemas, even at the time after that, because it was considered way too long. So we sort of had to redo something that already existed, but that for some reason, the entire reel that was screened for the Queen never showed up again. I don't know what they do with that stuff.
Maybe the royals are just hoarding it. Maybe the royals have a secret archive of all these films.
Exactly.
That...
Maybe we'll have to send our detectives there and see what is...
Right, we'll have to have a firm talk with His Majesty King Charles to please release the hostages.
Well, I think test screenings are also such a fascinating issue in that connection. You know, if someone sees it, might be the king or the queen, but normally it's just a random test audience and they get these cards back with all that feedback. And then based on that, of course, the whole studio machine starts to decide, well, this is perceived as a comedy, but it's supposed to be a horror film. So why not market it as a comedy instead? Or let's just take a half an hour out because it's far too long and people laughed at this instead of, you know, being shocked at this. So I think that malleability I find interesting in the movie making process. You think you have a screenplay, you have a cut. You show it to an audience randomly assembled in some secret screening, and then this is kind of the gospel. You know, what they say in that screening can ruin the career of a film, maybe even of a director forever, but the studio will somehow make sure that they still get the version that they will make money with. And that's also really fascinating, I think.
I mean, the thing with test screenings that always reminds me of is when I was at university and I lived in a shared house, we got out on video True Romance, the Tony Scott film from a Quentin Tarantino script. And we were happily sitting watching it. And just as it got to the end, one of my friends in the house just went, "But that's not how it ends." And we were all like, "What are you talking about?" And no, it's not how it ends. And he was just, "I've seen this film. I went to see it in the cinema. That's not how it ends." And we mocked him quite considerably for it. And it was only a few years later, sort of discovered the reality that he'd seen it in America. He was in California somewhere. And he'd obviously gone to see a film, wandered into that, did not realise it was a test screening. And so he saw the version where, spoiler, one of the main characters dies at the end. So he saw that, thought, fine, that was the film, left, went home. And then we were watching the VHS years later and could not understand how this person could survive. And we couldn't understand how, and we were all going, "Well, you must have misremembered it. You must have been." And the look of confusion in his eyes, because how could the film change? That seemed completely mysterious. And it was only much later it was solved that he'd seen a test screening without realizing he was seeing a test screening. And he'd seen the version that is now available on DVD. I think you can see it now as an alternate cut. But that is sort of, yeah, the sort of test screening world of like people get to see a version that then no one else, you know, might ever get to see.
Yeah, and there's a famous story even, I mean, focus groups go back a long way. There's a lovely story about Frances Marion, the film writer, and Mary Pickford. She was a very famous movie star in her day. And they would make comedies and they would have a lot of fun making them. And then the studio heads, you know, would purse their lips and go like, "Well, I'm sorry, but I don't think this is very funny, right?" And they used to sneak into cinemas where they have test screenings of their movies. And the story goes, and I don't know if this is apocryphal or not, but the story goes that they went in, you know, sneakily sitting in the back row for one of their movies. And the audience was just howling with laughter. And they both said, "We got it right. You bunch of accountants don't know what you're talking about. We got it right. This is funny. People are loving this." And some of the comedies got made, right? Or got their releases they were supposed to be. Now, again, this might be lore because this is early Hollywood and early Hollywood loves its mythology. But it's such a great story because it goes back such a long way.
There's a famous story, I think, with like Buster Keaton shorts, and I think even Fatty Arbuckle shorts as well, that they would always rail against that stuff would be snipped from them. And there's a story that one of Buster Keaton's short films had a gag at the ending that Buster Keaton always said was his favourite gag. He thought it was brilliant. And I think the studio kind of said, you know, it's maybe a bit too complicated. Can we end on something sillier? And this was like a famous lost scene of this final gag. And then it was found. And it is interesting seeing it because I think it hasn't helped the hype leading up to it. I mean, it's a good gag, but the mythology built that this was the greatest lost gag of Buster Keaton. It's the one he always said, you know, we were able to have some screenings with it, but then, you know, so it was in cinemas for a little bit, but then the studios were always chopping and changing and shortening, so they took it out. And yeah, it sort of, it has been like, it's fun. Another one which is slightly darker is on, I think, Fatty Arbuckle, when he was working with Buster Keaton. He had a gag that ended one of his short films, and it was taken out of the film on account of being a bit too racist. And if something is a bit too racist in the mid-20s Hollywood, you kind of think, where are you going with this? And bizarrely, that's been found as well. And I mean, it is racist, but I think the other reason the studio didn't like it is that there was just a non-white person on camera. I mean, I think that was an angle of it. But again, that these sort of, these scenes get found is sort of quite interesting, that they had, there's a mythology around sort of missing stuff. And then they can suddenly go, yeah, but we can see it now. And it's an interesting curio, but it rarely lives up to the myth.
And this, once this mythology bubble is burst, then we might find out that these scenes are not actually as good as we, you know, thought they were. And I think that brings us back to the Sausage Factory in Torn Curtain, or the dream sequence maybe in Spellbound by Dalí, you know, that we would love to see, but maybe it just wouldn't be as good once it is in front of us on the screen. But we like to imagine it's this Kopfkino that we call it in German. You know, you have a certain element of cinema only happens in your imagination, and obviously things that you just know exist but you've never seen, but also obviously films we've seen and we misremember them, and once we see them again, it's a completely different film. So maybe that's where the story with your friend comes in with True Romance. Maybe you just thought he misremembered the film, and he was obviously didn't remember it properly, but instead he had seen a different version of it. I have a couple of films that I saw in the as a child or as a teenager, and I'm still sure to this day that there were other versions that existed of them. And I recently found out that at least for some of the 70s films that Universal made, there were often additional scenes filmed that were just made for television. And it happened to be in the 70s period of mostly disaster movies that I watched as a teenager. And I recently found an edition of Earthquake that includes all these, I think it's like 30 to 40 minutes of additional scenes where they stuck some of the actors, mostly not the expensive ones, but the cheaper ones, into studio, and they filmed some additional material with them. And then they had this in television versions, I guess, throughout the 80s, maybe even longer. But you never got to see that if you watched the film version, or if you had the DVD or the Blu-ray. And at least for this example, they're terrible. You don't have to watch them. They're pointless, but they're so bad, so cheap. But they speak of a certain time when obviously a film wasn't enough, where you use the format of television to expand on it. And you had these 4-hour versions of Earthquake on Sunday matinees, and people wanted to see a few more office scenes and someone in a shaky fake plane, you know, flying over the earthquake, and they're kind of like having a dialogue that's terrible. So I think I must have seen certain of these films and later on wondered where these scenes went. The airport series is another example. So for a while, that was another way of creating additional material that just wasn't good enough to keep.
No, exactly. Some of that is just filler, right? It's like we now have the all new versions, you know, showing live on channel so-and-so. And it's just the film and a lot of filler that was left on the cutting room floor for reasons that are just good reasons, right? I'd like to sort of specify a little bit about the stuff that we still got, the stuff that was found, the stuff we've talked about, the Metropolis one, but I'm very excited. I have won a Kickstarter where a musician who happens to be an accompanist for silent films has rescored and redone an old Marion Davies film that was never released to ordinary people. It's people who could do, who can go to these very niche live screenings with accompaniments and so on. But for the general public, these things are not easily accessible. And if they are, they are these tiny little grainy black and white things on the archive. I mean, bless the archive, right, that we still got them, but I'd like to have a proper version, and now I'm getting one. This is also the way I got my Xander the Great, which I showered my appreciation on in a previous podcast. So some of this stuff is getting re-releases, very tiny re-releases, because simply the copyrights run out. But we've also discussed Pandora's Box, this beautiful Louise Brooks film that they have so lovingly restored to its original poignancy and grandeur. And it's such a gorgeous thing. We've discussed Nosferatu, which had several, I think, different treatments and different releases, which basically come down to the same thing, right? We have the same subtitles. Sometimes the music is a little bit different. That happens too. Cat and the Canary has several scores, of which I'm still angry that I don't get access to some of these because of geo-blocking, even though the film is more than 100 years old, people. Let it go, please. Anyway, do you guys have some particular restorations that you sort of really, I don't know, appreciate? Even if they're recuts, director's cuts, extra long director's cuts, or film music or stuff like that?
I mean, I always find a lot I enjoy about the saga of Once Upon a Time in America.
Oh, yes, you've written about that, haven't you?
And there is something about how it was originally released in the cinema and it flopped. And then they basically released a version that was, as you know, pretty much thought to be what Leone wanted it to be, which is now the version you can get commercially, which I think is I really like it as a film. I think it is it really works. It's a quite strange, slightly dark gangster film. And then subsequently, there's been almost two different versions I've seen, because they then found additional footage that was apparently from the original Cannes screening, was even longer than that version. And they released it in, I think, sort of the British Film Institute showed, a few places showed this longer version of the film. And it was that thing of like, actually, they were right to cut that. That first round of cuts was right. Nothing in the new material really is needed. It helps a little bit that the quality's not quite the same, so you can immediately tense when, oh, this is something new that's been added. But it really just sort of extends the film without adding anything. But then additionally, I found, I think it's on the Internet Archive, the original studio version that they basically tried to bury, you can't get it commercially, was the version that was released by the studio, which they took it off Leone's hands. They truncated it to a much shorter film. They tried to sell it as a very straightforward gangster story. And it was fun watching it. It's a terrible film. It really is bad.
That one's weird. Yeah.
But it was sort of quite interesting that, like, that version that, you know, was a big studio release at the time has now, quite deliberately, they're sort of removing it from public consumption. Almost they're embarrassed by the big studio take. And actually, I thought it was quite fun to go back to that. That was sort of a very enjoyable way of seeing something that felt a little bit illicit and secret, even though it is terrible and should never have happened. They should never have cut this film to ribbons. But actually, it's interesting that now those versions now are not seen as being acceptable. And maybe the sort of studio edits become, no, we don't want that anymore. We want the official version to be the director's cut. And then, you know, you have this conversation with Blade Runner. You have people who prefer the studio version to the sort of Ridley Scott version that came out. And I think it's an interesting argument either way. But there's definitely something about how it's interesting that studio cuts that were all the powerful one. This is what the studio wanted. Let's put it in the cinema. They're now the ones that are sometimes hard to get hold of, and they're quite interesting to see sometimes.
I was pointed to by our co-podcaster, Dan, from the States, to a fan version, this is not official, of Dune by David Lynch, and how that makes sense if you order it correctly and don't cut it to ribbons. And this sort of stuff sort of fascinates me, because it sort of begs the question, what is definitive? And at some point, something that's perceived to be definitive is some thing that is in someone's head who may or might not be living at this time. I mean, it sort of begs the question, what is original and what is definitive, right? Because an original screening, which is then adapted because reasons, I mean, there is a Kurosawa that was cut up, of which parts are now lost, that Kurosawa has, I think it's The Idiot, that Kurosawa has always mourned that as lost. And then you get this entire internet myth that we want the real thing, we want the original, but that one never really existed except in someone's mind. It's getting a little bit philosophical here. When you're talking about Once Upon a Time in America, the cut to bits original quote-unquote version is very bad.
Oh, yeah.
You know, it's really, really bad. So it comes down to the one that I prefer, which is the slightly sort of absurdist long cut and not the very ultra-macho, gangstery, social Darwinist, anybody who can beat anyone up wins, automatically game over sort of cut. I mean, the meaning changes of the film.
But I do think when we look now at like fan cuts being a thing, and I think because of going forward into the world of like streaming and people being able to get hold of stuff everywhere, is that that is probably just going to increase. That, you know, a fan who has a problem with a film now can go to the film and fix it. That, you know, they can now produce a version for their own amusement, but then stick it somewhere online that copyright doesn't look, and they can say, look, this is my fan version of this film. This is, you know, there's one bit of this film I never liked, or I never quite liked the ending. I'm going to make a fan version of it. And I think that's just increasingly probably going to happen, that we're not even looking at the studio version and the director's cut. We're going to be looking at all these different versions from all these different people. And exactly like you say, Julie, what will be definitive?
And fan edits have become, you know, so good. We just recently talked about Blue Velvet, Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me in another episode. And Matt actually sent me the fan edits of both, where you can watch now the, you know, the 4-hour version and the what so many hour version of these films. And I think, yeah, it is a philosophical question now, that because often the definitive version was the one that someone had power over, right? It was the studio who could say, this is the one we release. And then the director had no say in it until director's cuts became a thing. Now fan edits become a thing. If that's not somehow infringed upon by copyrights and the internet stays more or less free, then we can say, well, there will be a stable fan edit world. I'm not too sure that's gonna, you know, exist that stably over time, but yeah, it depends on that.
For the lawyers out there, we are not proponents of this because this is not legal, and if you are putting fan edits of existing films that are less than 100 years old online on YouTube, you can have your pants sued off of you. So I'm not a proponent of this, but it happens, and I am not going to do anything against
it. I mean, I it has that sort of weird feeling that if the technology allows it, it will become inevitable. I mean, have the strange world that I think enforcement sometimes with copyright, the studios sometimes go, you know what, we don't think they're making much money, we're not going to go and stop this from happening.
Exactly. And I think it should exist, right? It should exist. It's just for our listeners here, this is technically a tort.
But it's great that they're there, right?
But I mean, I think that what's going to be interesting is, of course, we talk about a fan edit, but there'll never just be one fan edit, because someone else will come along and say, you know what, I don't like this version of the film, I'm going to make my own version. And who knows what's going to inform it? You could end up with fan edits that were just like, how did you completely misunderstand the original film? You know, you wanted the sort of macho punch-up take on this film. That's not meant to be there. The film's meant to be more thoughtful. And I think it is going to come back to whether, going forward, it's going to be harder to pinpoint the definitive version, because there'll be the first commercial version, there'll be maybe that they then allow the director to have another commercial stab at it, there will be like all the stuff that might be released that's like extra missing scenes, and then you'll start getting all the different fan edits. And I think that's going to be quite crazy going forward.
Absolutely. And also in terms of preservation, you know, we started with this, but which versions are going to be preserved? How do you even go about saving stuff that was, you know, illegally produced, but maybe great? Are these just going to be lying around somewhere in the dark web or some internet archive until they're found by, I don't know, studio responsibles? So I think this was a huge question around. So yeah, how do we preserve the versions that come up now that, you know, have value, obviously, culturally, you know, if someone puts the effort in, but are they even standing a chance of really staying around or not?
I think this is a thing with streaming more generally, because I get these lists in my feed of the films that Netflix will no longer be showing after this month or next month, right? And the films that they don't show to begin with. And I'm sort of kind of worried, because that means that Netflix is gatekeeping what films get an audience, what films will get interest in them, right? And this is goes back to, again, making the entire leap back to these studios or distributors now deciding not just what's definitive, but what we get to see.
It's interesting, you kind of think streaming would be a free-for-all, but potentially it could become quite a clampdown, and we will lose being able to see versions of the films that just don't fit with whatever the streaming service guidelines are. So yeah, that the other side of future going forward could be quite dark.
Yeah, and no streaming service that is really, at least from, you know, from a European perspective, that is really dedicated to building a streaming platform where these things stay around. You have film classics, you have restored versions, you have all the material around it. So physical media stays relevant, at least for film fans, you know, that you have these versions available, that you have them in your shelf and you can pull them out, because they might be gone from all these channels at one point because of these clampdowns and these changes of preferences.
Gatekeeping, yeah. And exactly, DVDs cannot be stored incorrectly as easily as nitrate film can be stored incorrectly, and it will also not spontaneously combust, which is a good thing.
Good to know.
With the size of my film collection, that's very good to know.
That is very good to know. I think we're running out of time. Do you have any important final thoughts, guys?
No, I think we're good. I think we can cut anything else and just go with that.
Exactly. Rest lies on the cutting room floor. You know, join us for a cutting room floor episode.
The fan edit by Matt. All right. Thank you guys for joining me. It's been a blast. And thank you so much to all our listeners. Please join us again next time for another damn fine cup of culture. Goodbye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.